Come up here. So, I'm sorry I'm a day late, but that was due to circumstances beyond my control. So anyways, I'd like to talk to you about some work that we've been doing over the last year or two. So a lot of this is with Christoph Sieg. In fact, all of them are with Christoph Sieg and Olaf Olsen Sachs, who's my student who's graduating next week. So basically what I'm going to part of this talk is quite technical, although I'll try to skim over technical details. And part is speculative. So hopefully you won't be too, the technical parts won't be too tedious, or the speculative parts won't be too outrageous. But anyways. So there's sort of two very interesting superconformal field theories that have an integral structure in the planar limit. And one of these is N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and the other is called the ABJM model, and this is a Chern-Simons theory with superconformal matter. Oops, that wasn't supposed to happen. What happened? That's not good. Oh, you know what? I bet you I need my... it probably didn't take the whole file on. It probably only took the... It only had took the first two slides. Okay, here comes the Wagner again. Okay, well, what's that? Okay. All right, so where's my... All right, this is rather interesting. Okay, I'm trying to find kill my button. Okay, so here we go. I still can't find how to turn off the audio. Well, I just want to turn it off completely. Hi. Apparently, I only dropped two of the slides onto here. Oh, okay. Do you know how I killed the audio? Oh, it's there? Okay.
I just want to open up his talk first.
It's open now. Yeah, I found it. Yeah. Ah, there
it is. It won't go out now.
Okay.
But anyway.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Yep. Okay. I'm glad I was only music that was on the disc instead of thinking it was anything more embarrassing. Anyways, so there's many similarities between these two theories, but in fact, both of them have sort of a spin chain interpretation. Both of them have an SU2/2 substructure that's responsible for their integral properties. But ABJM has this extra function, which I'll call h squared of lambda. Lambda is the Atoff coupling in this theory. And this function is actually known to leading order in both small and large coupling, but it's actually not determined by integrability. So what I want to describe today is an attempt to find this function and what is known as its ABJ generalization basically through a for loop calculation. Okay, so I'll sort of discuss what this calculation is, both in component space and superspace, and I will give an all loop proposal for this thing is also dying. An all loop proposal for this ABJM, and also I'll discuss an all loop proposal for something we call maximal ABJ. Okay, now, so one reason we're sort of interested in this is that since this has nothing to do, since this function does not rely on integrability, but we know about it basically through ADS-CFT, that it, you know, sort of what its strong coupling behavior would be. So there seems to be something that string theory knows that integrability does not know about. So that's one reason we found this sort of interesting. All right, so let me just give you a review of what ABJM is. So many of you are probably quite familiar with it. So what this is it's a UN cross UN Chern-Simons term. There's two gauge fields, A mu and A mu hat. They come with opposite levels, K and minus K. And it's not just a pure Chern-Simons. There's also matter fields are involved. So they are either they're bifundamental fields, so they're either in the N and bar representations of the two gauge groups or the N bar Ns. Now, this theory has a large R symmetry group, which is SU4, which is equivalent to SO6. And it's going to be supersymmetric, so there's scalars, which YA and their adjoints Y bar A. Okay, the A is the SU4 index, which runs from 1 to 4. So if the index is up, it's in the fundamental representation of the R-symmetry group. If the index is down, it's in the anti-fundamental. The fermions, okay, so if Y is the NN bar scalars, the fermions, which are NN bar, have their SU4 index down, so they're in the anti-fundamental representation. And then the opposite for the N bar N fermions over here. All right, so this is the Lagrangian. Okay, so just I want to sort of just point out a few features of the Lagrangian, which will be relevant for later. Okay, so the Chern-Simons part, the minus signs are here because they have opposite levels, the kinetic terms for the scalars and the fermions. And then there's sort of three types of terms, interaction terms. So the first two lines here in red, these are pure scalar interaction terms. Okay, they're 6-point terms because we're in three dimensions. A scalar has dimension a half in three dimensions, and it's going to be super conformal. So these have to be 6-point terms in order to have dimension three. We have this line here in blue. This is scalar-scalar fermion-fermion interactions. So we will call these sort of uncrossed because it goes y y psi psi. And then on the final line, we have sort of these crossed interactions, which go, y, psi type terms, like that. So those are sort of the three types, sort of general types of interactions. Okay, so let me just tell you a few features about this theory. Okay, so it has an OSP 6/4 superconformal symmetry. Okay, so the 6 goes with the O, that's the SO6, that's the R symmetry. SP4, that's equivalent to SO2, 3. So that's the conformal group in three dimensions. And there's a large amount of supersymmetry. There's 24 supersymmetries, and it's 24 because it's 6 × 4. And the couplings are not renormalized. So everything is fixed. The beta functions are all zero. So the local gauge invariant operators are basically traces, okay, and which have to alternate between the NN bars and the N bar Ns, okay, in order for this thing to be gauge invariant. And so we will consider single trace operators, which is the normal thing people do when they study integrability. So we have sort of general types of fields. So the ones that are in the NN bar we'll call the chi's. The ones that are in the N bar Ns we'll call the chi bars. And so a chi can be a scalar with any number of covariant derivatives on it, or a fermion with covariant derivatives. And the chi bars are for the N bar N analogs of those. Okay, so an important class of operators in this theory are what are known as chiral primary operators. And so these are operators whose dimensions are protected by supersymmetry. So in particular, if we take a Y1 times Y4 dagger to the Lth power, and we take the trace of this, this is a chiral primary operator. So through all orders in perturbation theory, you'll find that the anomalous dimension is zero. So the dimension of the operator is basically the same as a charge, J, and J is basically one of the three SU4 charges. Okay, so Y1 would have charge a half, Y4 dagger also has charge a half for this particular J. They're both dimension a half fields. Okay, so the dimension equals J, and so delta minus J is equal to zero. The effect of coupling, okay, so that's square root of 4 pi over K. If you go back and look at the if you go back and look at what the action was, it was a factor of k over 4 pi in front of it. And so the Atuff coupling will be the number of colors n divided by k. Now we're going to be taking the planar limit, which means n goes to infinity, and we're going to want lambda to be finite. So that basically means that k has to be large. And k is actually, for Chern-Simons, it has to be an integer. But since it's very large, it's effectively continuous. So we don't have to actually worry that it's actually an integer. Another thing about this theory is that it has parity invariants. So normally, Chern-Simons theories are not parity invariant. In particular, the Chern-Simons action changes sign under parity. But actually, the other thing that changes sign in three dimensions are fermion mass terms. So they're not parity invariant either. And if you remember our interaction terms, we had several psi bar psi types terms. So those also change sign. Okay, but if we include with parity interchanging A mu and the A mu hat, okay, then everything stays invariant. So this is what we mean by the parity. The perturbative expansions will be even in lambda. Okay, and finally, the string dual on there's a string dual for this theory is ADS4 cross CP3 for large k, and this is classically integrable. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about how we find anomalous dimensions. So this part is will be relatively brief. Okay, so we want to consider two-point functions of the gauge invariant operators. So if we have an operator OX with O0, okay, it falls off as x to the minus 2 delta, where delta is the dimension of this operator. And the way you compute this is that you take, once you include loop effects, you compute the renormalized operator, which is given by the bare operator times some wave function renormalization term, z lambda. And the anomalous dimension gamma is just given by that particular derivative on z times z inverse. Okay, but what happens in these theories is that you get mixing between the operators. So actually, instead of having a z lambda be some function of lambda, it's actually a matrix function of lambda, zij. And so we can get mixing between operators once we include the loops. So actually, instead of a gamma as a number, we should consider a matrix, capital gamma ij, which you compute almost the same way. Okay, and then so we can define sort of a class of operators where these labels up here go with the NN bar fields. Okay, so chi P1s are some of these operators. Okay, and what this is that these sort of live in some sort of Hilbert space like this where if we have L sites, say, two L sites, one where two L sites, so that is two L fields inside there. Okay, then this maps into... we can map this into a Hilbert space, so a 2L-dimensional Hilbert space, or a tensor product of these individual 2L tensor product of these individual Hilbert spaces. All right, so the way to think about this theory is then we notice that since we have this alternation between the NN bars and the N bar Ns, we can sort of think of the trace as being like a spin chain where on the red side, say, correspond to the unbarred fields, and the blue sites correspond to the barred fields, okay? And this this anomalous dimension matrix up here, okay, we can think of this as a Hamiltonian acting on the spin chain, and this Hamiltonian maps these elements in this Hilbert space into itself under this transformation. I don't know why there's primes on here. There shouldn't be primes on. Okay. All right, so at tree level, there's basically, well, tree level, there's, when you compute the tree level, you just do a wick contraction between fields. Okay, so all you do is you just follow, you take one field over here, you wick contract it up there with another field, you wick contract like this, and you only consider planar diagrams, so no lines cross here, because otherwise they'll be suppressed by 1 over n, so we don't consider those. Okay, and so this Hamiltonian is basically zero at tree level. If we go through one loop, okay, so basically what we do is that when we consider these wick contractions going from the incoming field to the outgoing field, okay, like this, what we need to do is we need to insert, say, one of these sort of combinations like this. So we can insert this guy, say, into here. And so this would be the blue down here. This is this red one down here. This is this blue one down here. And then the outgoing ones are right here. Okay, and so we get an interaction term like this from that six-point vertex term we had. Okay, and you notice that there's two loops inside here, so this will give us a two-loop contribution to this Hamiltonian.
Really, you're right. But I've taken the complex. You should think of this that uncomplex conjugate. Okay, so really it should be O with O dagger. Okay, but I draw it that way. Okay. So
we can insert these different types of interaction terms here. So this would be coming from the six scalar. We can have an interaction term like this, say coming from where we have a scalar interact in two fermions and something like this, blah, 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 blah. And so if we compute what this gives us, so at the tree level, we find that we get sort of a, well, remember that the Hamiltonian,
let me go back.
So if I restrict myself to actually just two types of fields, basically, so if I just start with, I start with a ground state, which is one of these chiral primaries. So this is this trace of this Y1, Y4 dagger. And what I will do is I will sort of insert every now and then, I will replace a Y1 with a Y2, okay? And every one of the Y4 daggers every now and then, I will replace with a Y3 dagger. Okay, so what we're doing is we're taking this ground state and we're putting impurities into this system, okay? And we'll sort of restrict ourselves to this, these types of operators. Okay, so it turns out if I just restrict myself to these type of operators where I only have Y1s or Y2s or Y4 daggers and Y3 daggers, okay, that this operator will not mix with any other operator outside of this particular sector. All right, so if I go back, if I actually do this calculation, okay, so I do the field theory calculation for this particular setup, what I find is that this Hamiltonian is given by lambda squared times a sum over 1 minus PLL plus 2, which means that it exchanges, it will exchange, if this one, say, were a Y1 and this was a Y2, what it does is it interchanges the two in this interaction. So if this were Y1 and this were Y2, this would become a Y2 and this would become a Y1. Okay, so this would be the Hamiltonian at the two loop level for this particular system. Well, anyways, we only have exchanges between L and L plus 2, so not actually an exchange with the nearest neighbor, but actually with the nearest one of the same type of field. So only blues will only exchange with blues, and reds will only exchange with reds. Okay, so basically then what this Hamiltonian is that we basically have two independent spin chains, one for the odd sites, say the blue sites, and one for the even sites, the red sites. And this turns out to be the Hamiltonian for a Heisenberg ferromagnet. And you can actually solve this by using something called the beta equations. And so what we have are what are known as we have these UJs, which are known as beta roots. So for basically for every impurity I put in there, I have a beta root. So for every Y2 I have a UJ, and for every Y3 dagger I have a VJ. And they satisfy these equations like this, which basically is just a quantization condition in going around the sphere, going around the circle. Okay, and you can think of these UJs, okay, as these beta roots. Okay, these are related to, you can think of the these impurities have momentum on the circle, okay, and they're related to the momentum in this way. So either the IPJ, where this is the momentum of the impurity, okay, is related to the beta root this way. There's also a trace condition. Okay, it's not actually that important for us today, so let me not say much about it. But if you can solve these equations, okay, for these UJs, okay, then the energies of you'll know the energies of the individual magnons. These turn out to be related to this P, this momentum, by 4 lambda squared sine squared P over 2. Okay, so the bottom line is you solve these beta equations for how many, depending on how many impurities you put in, you solve them, you find the energy of the individual magnons, you add the energies up, and this gives you the energy for that particular system, but the energy corresponds to the anomalous dimension of our operator. So basically you solve it that way. Okay, and we can actually extend this. Okay, so this was just the SU2 cross SU2 sector. So these were our original beta equations right here. These are original beta equations here. We can extend this by basically adding more beta roots. Okay, that looks pretty messy. Luckily, this is not important for us today, so I will skip it. Now, let me talk about two different extensions then we can do from this two-loop result. Okay, so one extension we can do is we can, instead of doing the ABJM where we had UN cross UN gauge symmetry, it turns out that N doesn't have to be equal to M, and you would still have the same amount of supersymmetry. Okay, so this was done by ABJ. So we still have the same amount of supersymmetry, but now we have two different color numbers, N and M, so it means we can make two different TWF parameters, lambda and lambda hat. Okay, so in terms of the string dual, what this turns out to correspond to is turning on a background B field. Okay, and it's actually no longer clear if the string theory is going to be integrable. Okay, because normally, say so turning on the B field would sort of be equivalent to turning on a theta angle in a sigma model. And normally, when you turn on theta angles in sigma models, if you start with some integrable theory, you oftentimes do not end up with anything that's integrable. The other thing is, before in the ABJM case, we had a parity invariant theory, but that relied on exchanging two gauge groups. Now, if the colors are the numbers of colors are different, okay, it would seem that parity is broken. Now, the other thing, too, is that once we allow a UN cross UM type term, at two loops, we would expect sort of dependence on these combinations of the TUF parameters. So when it was ABJM, the two-loop contribution was proportional to lambda squared. Okay, but you might expect to have some lambda hat term, a lambda squared, or a lambda bar squared. And then then the question is integrability preserved in this case?
Yeah, it's still conformal. Yeah, it's still, everything is it's still conformal.
Even U shift.
Well, it's still OSP 6/4, so that's the conformal group for that. And the integrability it's not clear if integrability would be preserved. However, it turns out if you actually sit down and do the calculation, which is first done by Bak, Gong, and Ray, you find out that actually all that happens is that lambda squared you started off with in ABJM gets replaced with lambda lambda hat. Okay, there's no lambda squared or lambda hat squared term. And so that's the only difference. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is the same, except you replace with lambda lambda hat. The Hamiltonian was integrable at two loops. Okay, so it's still integrable. There's nothing changes except an overall constant. Okay, so it's still under the rule. Now, the other extension you can do is you can extend this calculation to higher loops.
Okay, so so when we're talking about N loops, interactions will reach over N sites. And it turns out that the odd and the even magnons each transform in an SU2/2 short representation. That's not too important. What's important is that given this, the fact that it's in a short representation, this dispersion relation that relates the energy of a magnon or impurity to the momentum, integrability tells you it's basically a half squared plus 4h squared lambda, some function of this lambda, times sine squared p over 2 minus a half. Okay, the beta equations have been extended, okay, all the to all loop order, okay, by Pedro and Golia. And the beta equations are basically completely determined except for this function, h of lambda. Okay, so anyways, this function, let me just say a few things about it. If, as I said before, it's not determined by integrability. Yep.
It's fixed just by SU2/2 symmetry, right?
Yeah, but this function, yeah, it's
no, the function, no, of course, yeah, but the function of form, yes.
Yeah, no, the dispersion
is.
Well,
even if it is not integrable, if the symmetry will be there, this is partial for
symmetry. Oh, yeah, no, that's true, that's true.
So
yeah.
Your own ABJ is integrable, why? If there is SU2/2, the formula that you wrote is correct for sure. The second square root. Or not?
That's not actually completely. Well, maybe I think it'll be true. I'm actually not sure about that because once I mix outside of the sector, I'm not. This should be true in any sector, and once I mix outside of it, I'm not actually sure that's correct.
Well, in any case, I'll write down if within this SU2 cross SU2 sector, I can always write down this function, okay, which will be extended. I'll have to extend it, you know, to be depend both on lambda and lambda hat. Okay, so in any case, h squared lambda is not determined by integrability. But we know at weak coupling basically what this function is. It has to be approximately lambda squared, so when lambda is much less than 1, and that just comes from that two-loop calculation I showed you before. At strong coupling, when lambda is very big, okay, we know from going to the BMN limit, okay, that this h squared lambda has to behave as lambda over 2. Okay. So anyways, unlike n equals 4, which is constant, so if this were an n equal 4 equation, in the n equal 4 case, all we have to do is replace h squared lambda by lambda over 4, and actually these halves become 1s. But this h squared lambda is just lambda over 4 pi. Okay, so it's at least it's believed to be. All evidence points to that fact. But in the ABJM case, it's an interpolating function. Okay, so it's not completely clear if this theory will be integrable if lambda is not equal to lambda bar. Okay, I'm not really going to talk about integrability today. Now, another question you might ask is we saw at the two-loop level that all we had to do is replace lambda squared with lambda times lambda hat. Okay, will that be the same case at higher loops? So can we just replace h squared? This just becomes a function of basically the geometric mean of the two lambdas like this. Okay, so we'll basically investigate this question up to at the for loop order. Okay, and so that means doing for loop calculations. And I'll say right now it's not pretty. I'll describe it some. So what we'll do is this function h squared lambda lambda hat, what we'll do is we'll write it in terms of lambda bar, which is the geometric mean of the two parameters, and we'll define another variable sigma, which basically is the difference between the two divided by the geometric mean. And so we'll write this function as a h squared lambda hat sigma as an expansion. So the leading order term is just lambda hat bar squared, as we saw. And then the higher order terms, we'll write it in terms of powers of lambda bar times some function of sigma, like this. Okay, so now the Hamiltonian is basically just, since we're in the SU2 cross SU2 sector, at least to this loop order, okay, the Hamiltonian is basically determined by the dispersion relation. Okay, so, and it's actually convenient to use something called anti-symmetric projectors. And the way you sort of do this is you define these bracketed terms here, which are basically sums, which are basically products of permutations. So for example, a chi A, okay, a chi A is defined to be just a permutation over A sites minus doing nothing, minus one, okay? So if you have a symmetric representation, okay, this would be one, this would be zero. Chi AB, okay, which is another one we'll run into, this will be some AB, so basically it's, you do two permutations over A sites and B sites, and then we subtract off one permutation minus the other permutation, and then we add one, basically, that way. All right, so if we take, if we look at the Hamiltonian in this case, you find that if we go back to our two-loop result, it turns out that this is just minus lambda bar squared times chi 1 plus chi 2. So this is basically, the chi 1 is just the exchange on the even sites. The chi 2 is the exchange on the odd sites, the nearest neighbor exchanges on those. And then the next order term would be lambda bar to the fourth. So there'd be two terms, one for the odd sites and one for the even sites. And so the odd sites has a chi 1-3 type term. So this is basically has, a, you have a, you have, you ha, it, which includes doing a permutation from one site over to here and then doing a permutation over to the next site over, like that, minus the opposite order, plus 2 minus H4 sigma of chi 1. And then the even site is chi 2-4, just with the even numbers here, and minus H4 of minus sigma of chi 2. Okay, and the reason for the minus is basically the odd sites, when you go from the odd sites to the even sites, effectively what you're doing is you're switching the N and the M. Okay, and so sigma goes to minus itself in that case. So if this is going to be parity invariant, okay, H4 sigma will each equal H4 minus sigma, at least if parity is preserved in this order. Okay, so that's the setup. And you can see that in order to compute this, that we want this H4 of sigma, okay? And so basically, it doesn't appear in these chi 1-3 structures. It only appears in these chi 1 or chi 2 structures. So basically, we just need to look at those types of terms to figure out what this H4 sigma is. Okay, so now we have to do for loop graphs. Okay, so let me just sort of flash by some of the graphs you have to look at. So first of all, you can see it's four loops, 1, 2, 3, 4. And what this is this basically has two scalar vertices. So you have 6 points coming in, 6 points coming out, and these are the different ways of doing that. So we have graphs like that. So we do that, and that was kind of a struggle. And then we have graphs where we have what are known as fermion triangles, where we have fermion triangles going in a loop. Again, these are four loops. So we have those. And then we have these, where we have fermion loops going through like this. And yeah, more of those. And then these. 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 And I think that's it. So these are all the graphs you have to compute. No, everything it turns out it's an even expansion in lambda. So the three loop terms don't matter. They don't contribute to the, so you have to go to four loops. I wish three loops mattered. So you get this. And, okay, I guess that was it. Okay, so these are all the graphs. Okay, and basically, I have to say that we were not very savvy about finding all the graphs in that. You know, we basically did it by hand, finding all the possible graphs. And we'd look around, and we don't find any grass for a few weeks. We think we're done, but then we find some more that we missed. But after basically of a half-life of about 4 months, I think we decided we had them all. So we think that, well, these are all the grafts. I'm sure they're all the grafts. Okay, so let me just say a little bit about what we do when we compute these things. I won't tell you too much. Okay, so the diagrams are evaluated using something called dimensional reduction as opposed to dimensional regularization. And basically what this means is that since this is a Chern-Simons theory, we have lots of epsilon tensors floating around, but they're always going to appear in pairs in our theory, okay? And so they can always be contracted with each other, okay? And so the rule is that when we contract the epsilons together, okay, we do that first, okay, and we stay in three dimensions. And then once everything is finally reduced to what are known as scalar integrals, okay, then we will dimensionally regularize. And this was shown, at least up to the three-loop order, that this preserves the Slavnov-Taylor identities. So we believe it's legitimate. Okay, although it's not been proven at four loops, but I think it's okay. Since we're doing dimensional regularization, what you want to do is you want to pick off the 1 over epsilon pole in these things and subtract off subdivergences and things like that. But in any case, let me just go right to the result. Okay, so after adding up all those graphs together, and there were lots of graphs, and there were lots of terms, and lots of cancellations, and lots of things like this. Okay, we have this function, a squared lambda of sigma. So two loop order, it's lambda squared plus h4 sigma, lambda bar to the fourth. Okay, it turns out that this h4 sigma is equal to h4 plus sigma squared h4 delta. Okay, so it's an even function of sigma. So at this level, it preserves parity. Okay, so it did not violate parity. And this is the function. These are what the H4s are. So H4 is so it's minus 4 sigma 2, zeta 2, plus sigma squared with minus multiplied by minus zeta 2. That's it. Okay, so after all that pain and suffering, you get this remarkably simple result. Okay, so that suggests that there's something going on, and I'll talk about that in a bit. Let me just say a few things about this. It's well, because we're looking in 1SU2 sector, yeah, it's the same. Why don't you do that?
Well, if you want to want to go to 8 loops, then you have to worry about other things.
Was the result known at sigma equal to zero?
Sorry, what's that?
Was the result known at sigma equal to zero?
No, this is a lot. Okay, so basically a year's worth of work to get that answer. So let me just say a few things though about this,
these coefficients. Okay, so first of all, the sign of this H4 is reasonable. Okay, so it starts out, weak coupling is behaving as lambda squared. It's strong coupling, it goes to lambda. So you expect the first order correction, the first correction to the function to be down, okay, to be negative, and indeed it is negative. Okay, so as I said before, this parity is preserved in this sector. The other thing, too, is that these coefficients, H4 and H4 delta, okay, they have what is known as the highest possible transcendentality, which basically, this is zeta, so zeta n is defined to have transcendentality n. When you're doing the calculation, you find lots of terms for this H4, okay, which have, which are rational, okay, and you have lots of terms that are multiplying factors of pi squared, okay, but after adding everything up, turns out all the rational terms cancel off. So basically, it has the highest, and so it's the highest allowed transcendentality. And the same is true for this. And I should also say that we originally had a sign error in some of our graphs, so we originally did not have that this was had highest transcendentality, but that was since been fixed. Okay. No. No.
Is there some kind of analogous things that's going on in it before that they can relate to?
Well, there's two stories about highest transcendentality, and that, well, okay, in n equals 4, so when You do, when you compute actually, if you actually compute, say, the dimension of the Kanishi operator, okay, to say a free loop order, okay, you can actually, the way the calculation was originally done was by taking this work by Vermassen and somebody else, for just ordinary, for an ordinary Yang-Mills theory. And what Lipikoff et al. Did is they took that result and they threw out all the lower transcendental terms, okay, and just kept the highest transcendental terms in that case, and that matched with the prediction from a beta on size. So in that sense, it has highest terms. It shows up in that case. It's something to do with supersymmetry, but it's all rather mysterious. Even the concept of transcendentality is a little mysterious to me, because you can define zeta functions is okay, pi, factors of pi, those are fine. But you can also define transcendentality in terms of harmonic sums. And harmonic sums are finite sums. So in some sense, it can have transcendentality too, but if you add the terms up, it looks like a rational number. So it looks like transcendentality zero. That's something I never understood.
Sorry, what?
Oh, well, but that's because of what broke down was they thought all the terms were going to be rational in the dimension of Kanishi, okay, twist two operators, in they thought all the terms were going to be rational, but then this dressing factor comes in at four loops, okay, and that adds some different, they added a zeta 3 term to it. So, well, you're laughing, I don't know.
No, I'll leave it. Suppose you take the spectrum with theory from the beta and the situation,
yeah.
You have your some H, it is not the one.
Yes.
Is this a reasonable spectrum for conformal fields in four dimensions?
Well, in four dimensions, H is just lambda over 4 pi. Okay, so I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Is, would any function of lambda be a reasonable answer for the spectrum of the conformal fields in four dimensions?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess what you're asking is, well, there's sort of a point of view that you can define the spectrum just by the spectrum of one operator. Say, you take the dimension of Kanishi operator, and that defines what your function is in a sense. And you don't care what the function is. And then from everything else, you derive it based in terms of how it relates to Kanishi.
Do you expect the family of conformal
I don't think so. I don't believe so. It's sort of determined by what the string theory is doing. It's also determined about what your regularization procedure is. Okay, and we always do. And for some reason, it seems to minimal subtraction is the thing we should do. And that's true in n equals 4 as well. That you get this constant. You get h 4 is equal to lambda. H lambda is equal h squared lambda is equal to lambda in n equals 4. I don't know.
This telling on zero is one deformation that you can do.
That's one deformation you can do.
But I think the beta equations are not known. Well,
no, the beta equations are not known in that case. Yeah. That's why I'm saying if I knew it was integrable, say, then basically the beta equations would have to be their beta equations with as a function of h lambda lambda I. Okay. Okay, so And also, the other nice thing you notice that is if you take this particular, if you take these particular coefficients and you plug them into this function, okay, actually, this function has a really remarkably simple form that it's just the lambda hat times lambda plus lambda hat squared times that factor of zeta 2. So anyways, we believe that this thing should be computable in another way.
That if it would be integrable, then h would be just lambda hat. There,
no, I'm not saying that. That's not no. That's not necessarily true. It can be a it can be any function of lambda hat. If it's integrable, though, so if you, all I'm saying is that the beta equations depend on this function h lambda hat. And if it's integrable, if the n equals 6 theory, if the ABJ theory is going to be integrable, it's going to have the same beta equations as the ABJM.
Right, but you're saying that doesn't necessarily imply that h. That you can just borrow the h when lambda equals lambda hat and replace it with a geometric mean.
No, but it still could be integrable, but it's not necessarily replacing the geometric mean.
Okay.
No, I mean, it was a curiosity, basically, so it seemed like maybe it would be the geometric mean. You know, and you're starting at two loops, but it's not the geometric mean. But even though it's not the geometric mean, it still has a pretty...
the geometric and the normal mean.
And the normal mean. Well, maybe that's what it will be. I don't know. So if you let lambda equals minus lambda hat, you'll actually see that the for loop term goes away. So although that would correspond to having a negative number of colors, but, you know, in large n, that doesn't matter. You can always make that continuation. So let me just say a little bit about doing the calculation in n equals 2 superspace. In this case,
it's more difficult to deal with superspace. On the other hand, you have much fewer diagrams, so it's a trade-off. The main thing is it served as a check for doing it the other way. So in this case, what you have is for the gauge fields, you have vector superfields V and V hat, and you have chiral superfields. In this case, the SU4R symmetry is not explicit. Okay, so we actually have two types of chiral superfields, ZA and WA, and the anti-chiral fields, Z bar, A bar, and WA bar, and A goes from 1 to 2. You have a Chern-Simons action in this language. You have the kinetic terms in this language. And you have the superpotential. So the superpotential, you'll notice, always comes with these epsilon factors in here. So it's a trace of ZA, WB, ZC, WD. Okay, and by the way, so the ZAs are in NN bars, and the Ws are in N bar Ns, all like that. And then also their complex conjugates. So the operators, if we're in the SU2 cross SU2 sector, is actually they're quite nice. Okay, and mainly that's because we can just construct them out of chiral fields only. Okay, so we don't have any anti-chiral fields anywhere in here. Okay, so we actually have we have completely chiral operators here in this sense. And because of this epsilon AC, epsilon BD terms, these chiral projectors, actually these anti-symmetric projectors, appear naturally. So at the two loop level, there's only one graph. This is it. Okay, and so this is not a bad graph to compute. And you can actually automatically see that it comes as 1 minus an exchange, because let's say this was a Z, this is a W, this is a Z, then this has to be a W, then this has to be a Z, this has to be a W, this has to be a Z. And it automatically comes out anti-symmetrized in that sense. So that's it for two loops. So looking at two loops, you think maybe it's not so bad to do four loops. And at four loops, there's many graphs you can draw, but lots of them are zero, okay, for various reasons. Okay, but these are sort of the graphs you get. So you have a graph that goes over 5 sites. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this involves 2 chiral vertices, right here. And it turns out that this particular graph is proportional to this factor of chi-1-3, chiral structure. Then you can have four sites, okay, which comes with a chi-1 factor, like that. And then we have three sites graphs like this. Okay, these all come with chi-1 factors as well. And that's it. So you can see there's basically 15 graphs you have to compute, and you get the same thing. Okay, so anyways, let me say now, okay, so that part of the talk was technical and straightforward and lots of nasty calculations. This part is somewhat speculative. So we want to actually make a conjecture for what this function is. And so basically it's Occam's razor, you know, simple as possible, that basically matches all the data. And we actually only know we only have a conjecture for the ABJM case where sigma is equal to zero. So what we're going to do is we're going to, instead of using lambda, we're going to define another variable t, which is equal to 2 pi I times lambda. Okay, so, and this particular combination shows up in these matrix model papers that have been appearing over the last year or so. And we'll define another, instead of calling it h squared lambda, we'll define a function gt, which is equal to 2 pi squared h squared lambda. Okay, so with this definition, then, the dispersion relation is given by this particular form here. Okay, and so the other thing you notice that given this particular form of the dispersion relation, in the n equals 4 case, all you're going to do is replace gt with lambda, the lambda in n equals 4 case. And well, again, you replace the halves by ones. Okay, here's our conjecture for our function. We believe that this is the function. Let me say a few things about this function. It has branch cuts at t is equal to plus or minus 1. Okay, so remember lambda is going to be real. Lambda is normally real, so t imaginary is where the physical region is. So these branch cuts are not on the physical region. Okay, that's good. If you look at its expansion of this function, okay, you see that it gives you the right expansion up to four loops. At strong coupling, sort of the reason why we ended up with this function is that after making this definition like this, you realize that you're going to need a factor of pi showing up at strong coupling. And this factor of pi basically shows up from the branch on the log. Okay, and so at strong coupling, you find that this function is minus I pi t, okay, minus 2 log 2 plus blah, 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 which in terms of lambda is given by this, and this turns out to be the strong coupling result. Now, one thing I should say about this is that this term has no one-loop correction, a one-loop sigma model correction. The one-loop sigma model correction would come with a square root of lambda term after the one-half lambda, okay, but that doesn't show up. Okay, so depending on how you regularize the sigma model, this matches with at least one regularization scheme, the one that's more natural in terms of the beta onsets. So you could say that it matches the first two orders at weak coupling and the first two orders at strong coupling. I'm just remarking, I'm not actually saying, they're at least not on the imaginary line.
Right. Why do you think it is possible to have a closed form for this g of t? Any other quantity in n equals 4 which interpolates is given by some interval equations, all quantities, community, Kasparov dimension, everything. And they will also look simple if you expand at weak and strong coupling.
Not this simple.
No. Kasparov dimension is roughly the same, right? It's also lambda squared plus pi squared over the a or something.
No, I don't know. I mean,
and then strong coupling also square root of lambda plus.
Yeah, no, I know, but
this is simple.
I think it might be the same. Well, in n equals four, the same function in n equals four is very simple.
Yes, but it doesn't interpolate at all. But as soon as something interpolates, it is typically a solution. I mean,
well,
all examples are given by solutions to interval equations.
Yeah, well, we can still hope to dream. What's that?
Yeah.
What?
Sorry. It's outside the area that Janet was saying.
Yeah, it's outside the area.
What about this Lord Lambda in the expansion? Isn't that a
problem? Well, I can show that. That would be in a, this would be sort of like a two loop run. Show up for two loops. I think that's possible to show up. I don't know. It might not be right.
Sorry, shouldn't it be an expansion just in alpha prime to in 1 over square root of lambda?
No, I think it's possible to have a long alpha prime term. I don't know, no one's done the two loop calculation. But. So more speculation. It's actually this particular structure of this proposed function. We know that actually, we can define lambda as just being minus I over 2 times t minus t bar. And the fact that we have this 1 minus t times the log of 1 minus t term, that looks a little bit like having something you get from a prepotential. Now, why the prepotential should depend on this t, I have no idea. Okay, but let's push on with it. So we can define this prepotential like this. So f of t is this particular combination like this. And so then we'd have the dual coordinate, which you find by taking a derivative with respect to a prepotential. And the dual coordinate is given by this, would be this particular term here. And so the dual Atuff parameter would be, you just replace the t minus the t bar with the dual terms like that. Then if you do that, actually you find out that actually that the dispersion relation is basically in terms of this dual Atuff parameter. So at strong coupling, the dual Atuff parameter is basically lambda. Okay, but at weak coupling, it's quite a bit different. Okay. So let me discuss one other possible limit we can take. So instead of going to the ABJM case where lambda is equal to lambda bar, we can consider a maximal ABJ case, where we let lambda, one of the lambdas be much greater than the other one. So we'll let lambda be much greater than lambda hat, say. Okay, and well, actually, we're going to be in the weak coupling regime, and the reason why we have to be in the weak coupling regime, basically, is because, I'll get to that later. But in any case, we'll assume that this lambda is also much less than one. So we can actually rescale our Hamiltonian in this fashion. We'll define lambda hat over pi. And if you're in the SU2 cross SU2 sector in this limit, then this h is just a pi lambda times this function of lambda squared times this 1 minus p term. So it's basically like we have two Heisenberg spin chains again. And we believe actually that this form will persist through all loop order. Okay, it'll always be 1 minus p times some function of this lambda squared. So, okay, we try to guess one function. Why not guess another function? So this looks a lot like sine pi of lambda, 1 minus p L O of 2. Okay, now actually let me give a few reasons why this actually it seems like a reasonable thing that this should be. Reason number one is that ABJ is basically thought to be ill-defined if lambda is greater than lambda hat. If lambda minus lambda hat is greater than one. All right, now we're taking the limit where lambda hat is much smaller than lambda. Okay, so it basically means that lambda has to be much greater than one in this limit. Sorry, lambda just has to be greater than or equal to one in this limit. Okay, and if this were the function psi pi lambda, what happens when lambda becomes greater than 1 is that this thing changes sign. Okay, and that would be a breakdown of unitarity because it would mean that there are operators in the theory that have dimensions that are less than the chiral primaries. Okay, so in that sense, that seems reasonable. And the other reason why this sounds reasonable is there's evidence that there's a relation between these two this ABJ theory where I have n plus l colors, okay, and this ABJ theory where I have n and n plus k minus l colors. They're thought to be equivalent.
Okay, so if I translate this into lambdas and lambda hats, okay, the lambda-lambda hat would be equivalent to a lambda hat theory of 2 lambda hat plus 1 minus lambda. Okay, and using the parity invariance that we found, and lambda hat is equal to 0, lambda minus lambda would go to 1 minus lambda, and sine pi lambda is invariant under that transformation. And that's, yep?
The function is level rank?
No, because this is only... And this is in the ABJ case. Well, the other function is that ABJM case. That was on the ABJM. Yeah. Okay. A few things though about this particular relation is that when we did the scaling here, the scaling was for the novel's dimension.
Okay. And the bare dimension does not scale this way. So normally in the string theory picture, the bare dimension does not separate out from the anomalous dimension, so that part. So basically this is only a perturbative result. In any case, we can't go to lambda greater than 1 anyways, because then the theory sort of breaks down. So you can't really compare it to a supergravity calculation with a gravity dual. And we don't really know what to say about other sectors as well. All right, so... So in any case, the for loop correction to this function is very very complicated, but at the end of the day, the result is very simple. Okay, so even if I don't have the right function, I believe the right function is calculable in a way that does not require doing Feynman diagrams. Okay, so there's lots of Feynman diagrams, but there's less than superspace. There should be a better way of finding it. Is there a sigma model calculation to do it? We don't know. We'd like to know if ABJ is integral beyond two loops. Okay, in order to do that, we have to go beyond the SC2 cross SC2 sector. If we do that, we have many more graphs to have to deal with, so we haven't had the energy to do that. So if there's a conjecture for GT that predicts the six-loop contribution to 8 squared lambda, and so that's the answer. Okay, but the number of graphs would be horrendous, so we haven't checked it. But maybe if we come up with some way of, well, I don't know. No one wants to do six-loop calculations. So. And we'd also like to find the function in general for non-zero values of sigma as well. So finally, let me end with this question, okay. Why is the function is a nice linear function in n equals 4 super Yang mills and more complicated in n equals 6 super conformal turn Simons? Well, to me, I mean, there's sort of a, there's been some work on why h squared lambda has to be a linear function in n equals 4 super Yang mills, but it's not clear. I'm not sure about it. Okay, so finally, let me remind you that I am an organizer for strings, so it's not too late to register, even though we're past the deadline. If you still want to register, it's still possible. So, thank you.
There was some paper by Bernstein.
That's right, yeah, Trancanelli, yeah. So Bernstein and Trancanelli, where, they argued that based on S duality, it has to be this function. But I don't quite understand why, because I don't, in the planar limit, okay, I don't know what S duality really is, the planar limit.
I heard at some point that one way of understanding that it could be linear for any plus four. Mm-hmm. Would be to try to relate this property to the property that the three-point functions of chiral primaries are not protected, are protected. Because, for example, is it true that there is such relation? I was imagining other branches, for example, and two BPS and two operators which are not BPS, and then the equilibrium they become BPS.
I've never seen it.
I don't know where it is. I just thought that someone told me at some point. I don't know if it's true or not. But it sounds plausible because if you put three point function with some Lagrangian, for example, it agrees with respect to one. At the angle, then
yeah, but there's,
the
but
two,
there's
and
no.
Then you put the other two to zero momentum, then it becomes BPS. And then the result should be protected. I don't know. Maybe in this way.
But the three point coupling won't show, G won't show up in the three point coupling. That's why, you know, the G angles.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be because it's exactly the derivative, because it's linear, and therefore if you take one derivative, you kill it, and then you are left with some.
Most accurately, wouldn't you expect that the four point function would give you a distinction of
I don't know. I mean, this is all.
I think there are no constraints from conformal symmetry. If you replace H of lambda by lambda,
yeah.
Nothing changes. It's only a relation between what are the parameters that appear in the Lagrangian and what are the lambda dimensions.
Right, yeah.
Right? But any constraints from conformal theory don't care about the Lagrangian. So.
Right.
The big equations are depend on H. So call H lambda and that's it. H is the coupling and that's it. And probably from two point functions as well. Everything will be expressed in terms of H. So if you can rename H to lambda and you're done. But the only thing is that, I mean, this theory, n and k are physical values, so you also want to relate n and k to h.
Right.
But that's actually a question that I have. It seems that all physical quantities, like spectrum energy of part, is just given by h of lambda.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how can you actually measure lambda in any physical observable?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think what it is that, you know, n and k are integers.
Okay.
So, in that sense, you know, they seem to be sort of fixed things that you put into the theory. And then from that you get a lambda. So maybe the question is that, you know, what, in the plane of limit, well, it could be, it doesn't matter, the plane of limit. But there are other things that would depend on k besides, you know, chiropractically, besides two-point functions.
Does it seem to you to go outside the plane of limit?
You have to go outside the plane of limit. The k is still there, in there, you know, there's all these, you know, things about k that show up in different things. So I think in a sense you're right. If we just had, if it was just like GA Mills, it's just some continuous coupling, then yeah, okay, then, you know, everything is determined by this function, which just happens to be linear. Okay, but in this case, you know, it's a relation between, it's a function, which is a relation between two integers.
In some sense, your lambda dual is in ABGM.
Yeah, it's playing that role, yeah, basically,
right.
Yeah.
So, can I get?
Yeah.
I mean, the first line on your conclusion was that you expect it to be simple, but so far you just showed that, I mean, at full levels that you have, the spectrum is still Pettit invariant.
Yes.
Would you expect that to continue at high level?
We expect it to continue. But we're not sure why.
Even though the theory is not Pettit invariant, but
yeah, it could be. It's just because of taking the plane of limit, it throws out all the Pettit violating sorts of times you get.
But you have, before all these cancellations, you had parity violating contributions from
No, actually, in those cases, in a sense, it's sort of by, no, that's true. Yeah, there were some cancellations with the parity violating things, but it wasn't so much like canceling all the rationals, there were all different types of terms,
okay,
sort of conspire to cancel.
So you could have predicted without doing too much.
Yeah, without doing too much work, we're pretty sure it's going to be better. Even when we had the answer wrong, we still tried to present.
I don't believe that's the suggestion for H of lambda, just monotonic.
Is it monotonic? Yeah, it is monotonic. No, I can graph it. It starts off, quadratic and goes off like that. Goes to range. Now it's monotonic.
So in using this localization techniques, it's possible to compute the partition function of S3 whole lambda, right?
Yes.
Is it possible to relate that to it?
We tried, and so one thing we tried was taking the free energy you get. This was before all the free energy, before this F theorem was out. And it looked like that if you... let's see if I can remember. If you look at the free energies, I think we had a conjecture that, okay, first of all, it comes with an overall factor of n squared of free energy. And I think some f and t. In fact, we chose this this t is defined the same way that they define it. And that's one reason we chose this. Okay. It seemed like if you took two derivatives on this function, you'd get something that was started out quadratic. Okay, so you take some derivatives on this and divide by the 1 over n squared. I forget exactly what the program was because it didn't work. So you get the leading term would be t squared, and then the next term would be t to the fourth times 1 over, t to the fourth over 1/6, which was good, but then it was multiplied by another factor of 2/3 or something like that. So it wasn't quite the same. And then at strong coupling, using this particular way of doing it, then it also behaved like you get the right t dependence at strong coupling, but multiplied by an extra factor of pi over 3 squared. So that's what we thought. Actually, that's what we thought is actually related to that.
Is there any physical way to relate to this computation?
No, not really. I mean, there's no real localization going on or anything like that, at least not that I'm aware of. In these F theorems, you know, they localize everything, so they turn everything into a matrix model. To me, I don't see any reason why they do a matrix model. I hope there would be, but it doesn't seem to
work. It's interesting, what is the alpha prime units of ADS radius? Would you expect it to be lambda or H prime?
In string theory it's lambda or lambda over 2 because the radius is off by a factor of 2. Defined in terms of n over k, alpha prime. In string theory, alpha prime 1 over alpha prime is equal to.
That's what multiplies the action.
Yeah, this is what multiplies the action.
But it could be renormalized.
It could be renormalized. Yeah.
So it could be
H1. Absolutely, yeah. That's what I understand what you're saying. Yeah. So it could be renormal. It could be this is the renormal value of random. That's what I'm saying. Perhaps
it should be, right?
It should be, yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's what I'm saying. Perhaps you can divide to find this from the sigma or something. In fact, one thing you might think of doing is somehow or other there should be an SO6 sigma model. because there's an analog for there's an analog you can do everything analogously as in n equals 4, and somehow or other you should be able to get an SO6 sigma model. Okay, but it's not clear how you get it in this particular theory. Somebody has, there's a sigma model out there by Bukov, okay, that doesn't look like an SO6 sigma model.
It has fermions as well.
There's massless fermions as well. So perhaps what happens is somehow or other that's equivalent to an SO6 sigma model, and with the coupling is H of lambda. It's not obvious to me at all how that would work. Yeah, in that case, they're massless fermions as well, so they play a role. So it's not just massless scaling.
Okay, let's turn to Joe again.